We're here at Menards Bag Sale, asking shoppers what they're putting in the bag to get 15% off.
Paint.
Batteries.
Tools.
Toilet paper.
Extension cords. Grocery items.
Hardware for my cabinets.
Snack items. Crackers and some canned good stuff.
Shop vac supplies.
Toothpaste, cereal, coffee, dog treats. I've got a lot of stuff to grab.
The list goes on, but the sale ends January 24th. Hurry in for Menards 15% off bag sale. See store for complete details.
Save big money at Menards.
This episode was recorded for my UK column show. Please keep us independent by going to support.ukcolumn.org.
This is Germ Warfare, the battle of ideas.
Ken McCarthy, thank you for joining me in the trenches.
Pleased to be here, and I had a lot of fun, as I was saying before, on my last visit with you. And I've been watching the show and really loving this show. This is good stuff, and I'm glad talking with you because you ask great questions.
You got a book called Diabolical Errors or Error. Diabolical, is it plural?
Well, now it's plural. It's
now
plural
errors.
Because we keep finding so many. It was just going to... It originally started with a very narrow outlook, and we've had to broaden it. So now it's plural.
Tell me about it.
Well, I think your viewers know me from a book that I wrote about John F. Kennedy and R.F. Kennedy. It was called JFK and RFK's Secret Battle Against Zionist Extremism. So people know me for that book. But actually... And I wrote that book because it's time, you know, it's time that we started talking about that issue. But my real interest is the health system. And that's actually the connection between me and Robert F. Kennedy Jr. That's how we connected originally. But like many Americans, like many people, I've been interested in the assassinations for a long time. But my real interest is in the daily assassinations that take place at the hands of our medical system. So the way Robert Kennedy Jr. and I met was during COVID. I heard that he is writing a book on Fauci. And I thought, oh, yeah, it's time. So I already had a stack. I can't even show you how big the stack was of material. I was working on a film. This was early 2020. And I will get to my book really shortly, but there's a preamble just to give everybody perspective. So I was already working on a film about Fauci, and this was in the early 2020 when the COVID thing was starting to percolate, because I had been aware of, I have a acquaintance who I've known a long time, Celia Farber, who was...
Oh, she's great.
Yeah. So it's really interesting story.
She was the first journalist, I think, who exposed the whole HIV/AIDS thing.
She was very early. And there was another fellow named John Lauritsen, she was as early as you can get. And she paid a terrible price. I can't think of anybody before or since that was ever more roundly punished for telling the truth than Celia Farber. I mean, it was really bad. Like all the canceling and all that stuff, lightweight compared to what she went through, because she was addressing the AIDS fraud when it was full blown, and there was a lot of money and a lot of power behind selling that fraud, and anybody that dared to say anything against it really came up against it. So I've known Celia for a long time, and interestingly enough, if you have any American listeners that are of a certain age, they might know of a great broadcaster named Barry Farber, who was Celia's dad. So I grew up listening to Barry Farber. So when I met Celia, it was like a huge deal. And I was very aware of her work. So I may seem to be drifting here. But anyway, so when Bobby was writing this book, I said, you gotta, if you're going against Fauci, his biggest vulnerability is AIDS, the AIDS scandal, the AIDS myth. Because at that time, that was his psychological foundation from a public relations point of view. He solved the AIDS crisis, and therefore he's the great man of medicine, and therefore when he says we should turn off the economy and close the schools and, you know, shut everything down and bankrupt millions of small businesses, we should just bow and do as he says, right? And so when I heard Bobby was writing a book on Fauci, I sent him all my research, which was vast. And like I said, I was working on a film called Fauci's First Fraud, which came out in August of 2020. So if people remember, this whole COVID thing got rolling in 2020. And so I do have to pat myself on the back that from February to August, I managed to put together a full-blown documentary on what a fraud Fauci was. And I showed how, and this theme appeared in Kennedy's book very strongly. I showed how the foundation of the AIDS fraud and the foundation of the COVID fraud, they were an identical playbook.
Yes, and I noticed that.
Yeah, yeah. And informed people saw it, you know, but it took a while. It took years. I mean, I went to a big meeting of resistors, COVID resistors, and I tried to explain to them that, you know, these were people that were into it. Like, this is what they were doing 7 days a week. And I tried to explain to them that, go ahead.
Sorry, if you don't mind, I was going to jump in because that comparison you made is exactly correct. So many people did not see the overlap between the AIDS narrative and the COVID narrative. Both used PCR testing. I don't know if you know, because South Africa was a hotspot for the whole HIV thing.
Absolutely.
And our former president, Thabo Mbeki, back in early 2000, he put out the AIDS report in conjunction with a pile of dissident scientists. And in it, it recommended against trusting PCR tests for HIV.
Yeah.
Everybody ignored that. And there we were again in 2020.
Yeah. And we'll get into that in this call in detail. And I also want to, we were talking earlier about the infrastructure of the internet connection from Africa, and it's not always perfect. But you know what? There have been a lot of strong African resistors, not only to AIDS, but also to COVID. Remember the fellow, I forget what country he was from, and he sent a swab from a papaya.
The president of Tanzania.
Yeah, who, by the way, died in a hospital.
Yeah, just coincidentally.
Yeah, I mean, people should not forget that that happened. And I wrote another book, and we're going all over the place, but I promise your listeners that it's all going to come together. I wrote a related book related to the COVID catastrophe called What the Nurses Saw. And it's been a bestseller, even with no promotion, mainly because a lot of resistant nurses that are resisting have been supporting it and talking it up. It's my estimate, and I make the case in the book. I did the research first and then made the analysis, but it's my analysis that many, many tens of thousands, possibly hundreds of thousands of people were flat out killed as a result of the COVID protocols as they were used in the hospital. And the thing is, when we're sitting on the outside of a hospital feeling well and in control of our lives, we can't imagine what goes on in hospitals. But, you know, once you're in the hospital and you're in that bed, and let's say you're not feeling well or you're very frightened and you're cut off from all outside contact and all outside.
Bag huge savings on your painting projects at Menards. From your kitchen and bath to doors and trim and even your ceilings, Dutch Boy has the perfect choice for your painting projects. Dutch Boy's DuraFighter is a tough paint and primer that provides great scrub resistance and durability. DuraFighter interior paint starts at $27.75 a gallon. Get an additional 15% savings on all Dutch Boy paints when you put it in the bag. See store for complete details.
Save big money at
support. They can pretty much do anything they want to you. And I don't want to make people paranoid, but it's very important if you're going to the hospital to make sure that you have somebody who is advocating for you, who's checking up on you and making sure that you're being treated properly. That, by the way, was structurally impossible in the United States during COVID, because once you were declared a COVID patient and put in a COVID ward, you were not allowed any contact with your family, with your own personal physician, with your attorney, with your priest or your religious leader. You were on your own, and they were plying people with remdesivir, the super invasive venting that they would put people on in the drop of a hat. And after I wrote the book, because I focused on the nurses' testimony, and we have nurses from all over the country and Canada, and it's pretty clear it was a system-wide thing. They were very keen to put as many people on remdesivir as they could. They were very keen to put as many people on invasive ventilation as they could. In the United States, there was a very strong financial incentive to administer remdesivir. The hospitals actually got some kind of a bonus, and it was thousands of dollars. They were also received a bonus if they put people on, and a multi-thousand-dollar bonus if they put people on ventilation. Bizarrely, they were given an additional bonus if they kept people on the ventilators for 96 hours or more. Now, this is total medical madness. The profession that monitors patients that are on invasive ventilation is called respiratory therapist, right? And it sounds like a modest thing, but it's not. It requires a lot of training, many years of training. And basically, being on a vent is a very medically dangerous situation. I mean, you understand. And you know, there are cases where, hey, this is the only chance we've got. This person's been, you know, in a multi-car wreck and the diaphragm's not working and this is it. But
your chances of coming off are very low.
Very low. And your chances of coming off healthy are very low because we're kind of going in a total different direction, but I think this is important for people to hear. You know, it's not that they just put a little face mask on you. They literally put what they call the garden hose down your throat into your trachea. And in order to do that, you have to be knocked out. You have to be given what they call paralytics, drugs that keep you from moving. And you have to be given analgesics, including, you know, they use fentanyl. I mean, because you can imagine, you know, we're not designed to have garden hoses stuck down our throats. So, and it's not just you take a pill and you fall asleep or they give you one injection. There's a line of intravenous with bags to keep you under. So that's not healthy right there. If they don't set the ventilator correctly, they can blow your lungs out. And they did not have enough qualified respiratory therapists to do all the venting.
Can I tell you a bit of trivia? So I remember back in 2020, I was having this discussion about ventilators with an anaesthetist, a friend of mine here in South Africa. And he was saying that suddenly they were putting people on ventilators and the people operating the ventilators had no idea what they were doing. Here in South Africa, they apparently only something like 100 skilled ventilator operators, so whatever the right term is.
In the US it's called respiratory therapist.
That term there, right? There's apparently about 100 of them in South Africa, and they had way more people operating these machines, which is insane.
Oh yeah, I mean, here's how it works in the real world. A respiratory therapist, and again, it sounds like something that teaches you how to breathe better. It's a terrible term, but it's a very technical position, and their job is to specifically monitor the people on invasive ventilation. It's not unlike anesthesia. I think it's kind of like a trade thing, a money thing. It's like anesthesiologists get paid this, you know, and respiratory therapists get paid this, but they're kind of doing the same job. But a respiratory therapist generally will only be managing 3 or 4 patients total.
Yeah.
All right. So, for example, the very first story that came out of the U.S., which came via the wonderful, marvelous, and I've got to look up her name, Erin Marie Olszewski. She said they had a whole floor full of people on respirators with only one respiratory therapist. That is a recipe for death or severe disabling, right? And you're right. They had doctors, and it's a, you know, imagine it's a pipe. You're sticking it all the way down somebody's throat. You want somebody that's done that before. You don't want somebody that's figuring it out that day for the first time. And unfortunately, that's what was going on in these hospitals, because a respiratory therapist in the States cannot put the hose down the throat. That has to be done by an MD. Okay. So on these wards, on these COVID wards in the United States, they hired anybody. Like, they didn't have people with ICU experience. They didn't have people with anesthesia experience. Anybody that had an MD could work on a COVID ward. Even more bizarre, I don't know how they did in other countries, but they waived all the laws for medical qualifications. So you could be the finest surgeon in Germany, for example, right? And you could arrive in the United States and they'll hand you a mop. That's the job you're going to get in the United States. You have to go through all the steps to get certified. Now, it doesn't care what you did in Germany or what you did in South Africa or how many papers you've written or how many, you're nothing, you're a zero. They waived that law for the first time in American history. And any MD who could fog a mirror, whether they could speak English or not, whether they were qualified or not, as long as they could persuade the job contractor that they were a licensed MD somewhere on the planet, they were allowed to come to the United States and work as physicians. So on these wards, you had doctors that had no ICU experience whatsoever. Some of them could barely speak English, and they were being paid a king's ransom. I mean, it was unbelievable. Mm-hmm. I know the nurses, the contract nurses on the COVID wards were being paid in New York City, where the COVID supposedly exploded in the United States. They were being paid $10,000 US a week. That's $500,000 a year. Yeah, so let's get on. So what people can get today is, this is the excerpt version, all right? I just wanted people to have something in their hands. So it's five chapters. The book itself is going to be, it's vast.
Well, that's the one I've got, this one that you held up.
Right. And people can get it. It's available via Amazon. I priced it at break even, so I'm not making any money on it. But I just want people to realize this bigger book is coming. And so there's the chapters talk about Pasteur, what medicine was like before the 20th century, the fact that the military, those are chapter in this new excerpt, in this excerpt version, those are the two chapters. I also discussed the fact that the idea of coerced mass vaccination, military, from day one, they were the ones that cooked that up. That did not start as a public health initiative. We also talk about the utter corruption of medical education, which took place at the hands of Johns Hopkins Medical School. If you followed the COVID news and you remember, there were always reports.
We're here at Menards Bag Sale, asking shoppers what they're putting in the bag to get 15% off.
Paint,
batteries,
tools,
toilet paper,
extension cords, grocery items,
hardware for my cabinets,
snack items, crackers, and some canned good stuff,
shop vac supplies,
toothpaste, cereal, coffee, dog treats. I've got a lot of stuff to grab.
The list goes on, but the sale ends January 24th. Hurry in for Menards 15% off bag sale. See store for complete details.
Save big money at Menards.
It's coming from Johns Hopkins, you know. Johns Hopkins says this, Johns Hopkins says that. Well, what I learned from the research in my book is they're sort of like the engine room of medicine in the United States, more than Harvard, more than Yale, more than any of those other famous schools. And it started on a very, very corrupt footing. I mean, just, I'll tell you, people have heard about Rockefeller and his involvement in medicine, and a lot of people know about it vaguely. And so one of the things I do in this book is I get into the details. So one of the many things that the Rockefeller cartel did was they took Johns Hopkins, which was a pretty brand new school at the time, and they made it the, quote, gold standard for all medical education. And they literally said to all the medical schools in the country, if you follow the Johns Hopkins model, we will fund you. If you don't, we will destroy you. I mean, that's that, you know, when you get rid of all the niceties, and they succeeded. any school that followed Johns Hopkins model was funded and supported and enabled and so on. And any school that didn't was literally run out of business. And it's complicated the way they did it. But and it takes a chapter to explain. But basically, they used every conceivable means. They worked with the government. They worked in the U.S. medical practice is actually regulated state by state. So you have to convince 50 different states to do anything. And the Rockefeller cartel had the money to do that. And they relentlessly went state by state by state and eliminated any medical school that wouldn't follow the Johns Hopkins model. Now, what's weird about the Johns Hopkins model, and this will all, I promise to your listeners, this will all come together shortly, is they were very inspired by the Prussian approach to medicine and medical research. And the Prussian approach, as you can imagine, everyone knows what a Prussian is. You know, they're marching around, goose-stepping, and they were the forerunners of the Nazis. They were a highly militarized society. I mean, thoroughly, this, I don't think there's ever been a society, maybe Sparta, I don't know. We don't have pictures of Sparta. But in our modern time, nothing compares to the militarization. And they militarized everything. And one of the things they militarized was medical research and medical education. And in Prussia, they got enamored of the idea of making animals sick, injuring animals, and then studying how they died and taking careful notes and practicing all kinds of garish operations on them. This is what they loved. It was called experimental pathology. And the guy that founded Johns Hopkins Medical School loved that approach. And he brought that twisted medicine. I mean, never in the history of medicine has the study of medicine ever been based on the injuring and poisoning of animals and documenting how they die and then trying all kinds of crazy things to revive them. That's never been part of medicine. But that became what the Prussian militarized state was really interested in. And that model got implanted in this newish university, medical school called Johns Hopkins. And then the Rockefeller cartel looked at it and said, yep, that's what we want. So whereas in, let's say in Europe, somebody can, you graduate from high school and you go straight to medical school. I don't know if that's the same way in South Africa, but that's the norm in Europe. And you start working with patients right away. I mean, you basically follow around a doctor. I mean, you go to laboratory and you study and you listen to the lectures. You got to learn all the hard stuff. But you immediately start observing the practice of medicine. In U.S. medical school, thanks to Johns Hopkins and thanks to the Rockefeller cartel, you spend the first 2 years doing nothing but studying you know, pathology, and these aren't necessarily bad things. They merit attention, but the whole thing is cast in pathology, and it's also cast in learning the biochemistry of pharmaceutical drugs, right? And the students never, and I've talked to medical school students, they never learn it well enough to fully understand what it is they're being taught. I mean, they know how to regurgitate it on the tests, and they spend hundreds of hours. But they end up with an indoctrination that this is medicine. So medicine is, what is the pharmaceutical solution? What's the make-believe methodology by which it makes people better? There's so much in this new book that's coming out, whenever it comes out. To get into a medical school in the United States and possibly in other countries, I don't know, I'm just focusing on the US, you have to master organic chemistry. Now, organic chemistry sounds lovely. It sounds like, oh, it's organic. No. Organic chemistry is a misnomer. It's just chemistry related to anything that has a carbon atom in it. And so that is basically the chemistry that you would learn if you're going to be a pharmaceutical drug engineer. Okay? Nobody else in the world needs to know organic chemistry. There's no medical practice, not surgery, not pediatrics, not infectious disease, where so-called organic chemistry has any role at all. You understand? Like it's like saying, well, you want to learn to drive a bus, we want you to spend master ancient Greek. That's the relationship between the practice of medicine and so-called organic chemistry. So You have to master organic chemistry in order to enter medical school. So that eliminates any kid who's not, frankly, rich, can go to a really good school and can afford hundreds and hundreds of hours studying a subject that is completely esoteric. So now they get themselves into medical school, and the first 2 years, it's all drugs and drug actions and how the drugs affect and this and that and all the pathologies that occur. There's no education as to how to treat human beings, like how to keep them healthy, how to restore their health. It's only if you get, and this is comes from the Prussians, if you get this lab result test, and now we're going to AIDS and COVID, then you treat them this way. Period. Like, you don't need to act like you, like, so there are some real doctors left, but the young doctors that are coming up now, all they know how to do is order tests, read test results, check which drug gets prescribed for which test result, and prescribe the drug. That's all they know. They don't know anything else. And that's all that all was formulated in the Prussian state in the 19th century, and it got put into the United States. So then the United States, of course, being a super influential country, all the other, you know, the third world countries and, the, you know, all the other countries all over the world look to the United States model and go, oh, that's the way to do it. When somebody graduates from medical school in the United States, they are so useless as a physician that they can't practice medicine until they've spent 3 to 7 years doing what they call residence, which is where you go and you actually do things with people. Like, they spend 4 years in school basically never evaluating a patient, never, you know, it's mind-boggling, right? And by the way, that system was created at Johns Hopkins. It used to be a highly abusive system. Now it's only an abusive system. The highly abusive era, they would literally, no exaggeration, be on the job 80 to 100 hours a week. Okay, now sometimes people exaggerate, they go, oh God, I'm working 80 hours a week, and you look, they're really working 30, you know. But these guys were literally on call. That's a lot of hours. And that would go on for years. And they were low paid, and they were abused, you know, they were treated badly. So an American physician, in their college years, obsesses over getting straight A's and mastering organic chemistry, which has nothing to do with the practice of medicine. Then they go to medical school. They never learn how to work with patients, but they learn that these great pharmaceutical products have these amazing effects that we kind of understand, but we don't really understand, but we've spent so many hundreds of hours in the classroom hearing how great it is, we just assume it's true. They get to the end of their 4 years, they're not capable of practicing medicine. Now they have to do 3 to 7 years in residence under what was used to be a very abusive system. And again, I think it's less abusive. But here's the crazy thing. The person that invented the residence system was a cocaine addict. He was a professor. This is the man that established medical education in the United States and for the world. Was a cocaine abuser. He blew himself out so badly he had to disappear for 2 or 3 years. He came back as a morphine addict, and he got off cocaine finally. Excuse me. I think the last time this happened, I got so excited I needed to drink water. He came back, and now he's just a morphine addict. He remained a morphine addict for the rest of his life. This was the man who set the template for the residents' education. So when we look at our doctors and we go, why did they go along with this COVID thing? Why didn't they stand up? Why didn't they see what every normal person of sound mind could see? They have been so indoctrinated, it's almost beyond our ability to imagine how indoctrinated they are, but, you know?
Yeah, so, I mean, Ken, is that why you call the book Diabolical Errors? Because an error suggests that they were possibly just acting in good faith, but they had misinformation or they had the incorrect information. But in many respects, I don't think they acted in good faith.
Well, this is the question of the age, and the title of the book comes from Augustine, right? Saint Augustine, and he said this: "To err is human," which is true. You know, we're never going to get it right 100% of the time, and doctors won't either. But to persist in error, this is the second part of the quote, when you know is wrong, is diabolical. And so, and I first thought about this when I was doing the research on the what the nurses saw. I thought, well, I can understand if somebody tells me there's a brand new disease, never before seen on this planet. How that happened is a question. How could something, anyway, never before seen, and it's deadly, and you just look at somebody and you automatically get it, and there's no cure. But ha, we have a cure. It's this bag of Remdesivir. And I believed all that.
Maybe it's this injection.
What's that?
Oh, it's this injection.
Yeah, well, that came later. So first they terrorized everybody. This is by the way, straight from the AIDS playbook. We were talking about that earlier. I grew up in that era. I was in my 20s in the 1980s. And this may be a sidebar, but it's very important for explaining this whole system. Oprah Winfrey, who's a big deal, I don't know if that's a name known to your viewers in South Africa, but she had the biggest TV show in America. I think on her highlight, she was getting 40 million viewers a week, you know. I think she started on a mainstream network, but in any event, she had a big television show. And in the late 80s, she told her audience, one out of five of you will be dead from AIDS by 1990. That's terrorism. That's terrorism. And she had gotten that from Fauci, and then that whole, you know, they wanted to, well, we don't want to go too off on that. But the point is, the terror campaign during AIDS was intense. And the other terrorism was like, have you ever had sex? Yes. Has the person you ever had sex, have they ever had sex? No, but even more diabolical. Now, do you think the person you've had sex with ever had sex with somebody else? You know, like, probably. Okay. But she's okay. You know, she's not a, you know, drug abuser or something. But do you know who the person she, so, you know what I mean? Like they would, but do you know all the people that she had sex with, who they had sex with? In other words, they use that model to basically say, look, you have no idea what you've been exposed to. And you may have this virus. And boy, if you have it, you're a goner. So they kept that up for years. Longer than COVID, they kind of like, after a year, they came out with the cure. Actually, sooner with Remdesivir, but that's another story. So there was a long wait. When they finally came out with AZT, which was pure death, many people flocked to it. Millions of people. Some people were coerced. They were compelled to do it. But a lot of people just said, oh, my God. Because what happened was, going to PCR, they would do a really bad test. There were over 100 ways to get a positive HIV test. Over 100 ways to generate an inaccurate test. Like if you had the flu, if you were pregnant, if you, I can't remember all the, it's just like a long, long list of things that could trigger.
Did you watch that documentary called House of Numbers, which came out around 2010 or somewhere there? In it, they showed that the one of the most pervasive HIV tests across Africa was basic eyeballing.
Oh yeah, yeah. Have you? Well, here's the thing. Have you? Oh, what was it? They had two standards, and if you like had a fever, if you'd lost 10 pounds, if you, I don't know, I forget, it was just something that anybody could have if they were really super run down. If you had that in Africa, you had AIDS.
Yes, in fact, sorry, I keep interrupting you, but...
Oh, please, it's good.
So what happened with the, in South Africa, for example, if you had TB and you tested negative on a PCR test, then you simply had TB and you were, you know, HIV negative. If you tested positive and you had TB, TB didn't matter anymore. You were now HIV positive.
Right.
And TB was secondary. It's ridiculous.
It's even worse, right? Because they had this, we talk about PCR, and PCR was a factor, but they had these really crappy tests. I can't remember the names, and they had, you know, the Western blot and all this kind of stuff.
ELISA also.
ELISA. And these were garbage tests, pure garbage. And like I said, you could sneeze and then take a HIV test, and they declare that you were HIV positive. You had an active HIV infection. Once you had that, then they would manage you with PCR. So it was so there was actually a two-step process during the AIDS thing. They would do these crappy tests. Everybody would come up positive, and then once you were positive, now they put you on PCR. The PCR is based on amplification. They take a little piece of genetic, you know, sample, and then they replicate it over and over and over and over again. PCR was developed by Kary Mullis. He won the Nobel Prize in Chemistry for it. It was meant to be a manufacturing process to assist genetic science, genetic research. So, you know, you get a little piece of genetic material and you got to wait, you know, a month for it to get to be big enough to work with. With the PCR technology, it should never be called PCR test. It's the PCR technology. You could take a small piece of...
We're here at Menards Bag Sale, asking shoppers what they're putting in the bag to get 15% off.
Paint.
Batteries.
Tools.
Toilet paper.
Extension cords. Grocery items.
Hardware for my cabinets.
Snack items. Crackers and some canned good stuff.
Shop vac supplies.
Toothpaste, cereal, coffee, dog treats. I've got a lot of stuff to grab.
The list goes on, but the sale ends January 24th. Hurry in for Menards 15% off bag sale. See store for complete details.
Genetic material and amplify it very rapidly. So Fauci and friends during AIDS said, oh, this is a perfect way to detect the HIV virus in people with active cases. And then they ran that same scam during COVID. And Mullis was very clear. He said, this is not a diagnostic. This is he didn't totally explain it perfectly, but he was very clear that it was not meant for medical diagnosis, that it was a terrible tool for diagnosis, because basically it's an amplification thing. All right. So let's get back to, the model, we were referring to this really earlier in the call. The playbook for COVID was the same as the playbook for AIDS, which is, hey, you've got some symptom. Well, we'll swab you with this crappy test. We'll declare that you've got the COVID virus, you've got an active COVID infection, or you have an active HIV infection. None of these things mean anything.
Exactly right. They mean nothing. I mean,
yeah. So you have absolutely no symptoms at all. You're totally healthy. And then they say, you're a secret carrier. And they did the same on both cases.
Did you listen to the conversation I had with... A South African, he was told, I think around 23 years ago, that he was HIV positive and that he had 2 to 4 years left to live.
Right, right.
And it destroyed, as you can imagine, his life from that point on.
Oh, yeah.
And he was perfectly healthy. And today he's perfectly healthy.
There was a man in New York whose profession, it was a positive profession, was to dehypnotize, we'll use that phrase, all the people that had been told they were going to die of AIDS, who had no reason. They weren't dying of anything. They weren't even sick, but they were mentally crushed. Because, again, it's hard to explain unless you live through it. Well, if you live through COVID, then you kind of know what a medical terror campaign is. But it was very strong in New York City too as well. And I mean, I know of one case of somebody I actually knew. I mean, he was a teacher. I went to a workshop that he gave, so you know, I knew him. He went home, blew his brains out. Because the model was if you test, first of all, the whole thing was a lie. If you test positive for AIDS, well, it's no such thing. Basically, and they look through a microscope and they see the little HIV thing swimming around, which of course it can't do because viruses are not alive. But anyway, they've decided that the presence of a virus is proof of an illness. So all that they were doing with these tests was, oh, well, we see the presence of an antigen, which suggests that there might have been this virus that we theorized called HIV, and we say that HIV leads to AIDS. That's how thin this thing was. But they had millions of people terrorized, and when AZT came out, and AZT, you were probably aware, but let's let everybody know, was banned. It was such a toxic substance. They had tried to use it to treat a form of cancer, and it was like, wow, this is killing people left and right.
It's a chemotherapy.
It's a horrid Yeah, it's a chemotherapy, and it's a known carcinogen. It's a known mutagen, and the FDA said, you know what? Don't even test this. Even if somebody says, hey, I'm willing to sign the paper, I've got terminal cancer, let me do. The FDA said, no, not even a terminal cancer patient, you don't want to give them this thing. Somehow, magically, Fauci navigated the bureaucracy in such a way that this deadly drug became the go-to drug, and they were giving it in mass. They were waking guys up, so you'd have to get it every 2 hours. All right. First of all, it was a killer dose just to begin with. Then they give it every 2 hours. They would wake these poor guys up in the middle of the night, you know, midnight, 2 o'clock, 4 o'clock, 6 o'clock, 8 o'clock, and give them their next dose of AZT. And guess what? They were and if you read the box, and you saw this in the film that you referenced earlier, the box says it's going to destroy your immune system. You know, it's like this is one of the
I believe that Freddie Mercury was killed with AZT.
All these guys were killed. They were all the original generation of people that, quote, got AIDS. There was a social phenomenon in the 1970s and the early 80s. It was sort of liberation time. And there was a small percentage of the male homosexual community in certain cities like New York, San Francisco, LA, Atlanta, you know, Miami. And young guys, and they were going wild by any standard. What's that? Poppers, did you say? Yeah.
Yeah, poppers.
I mean, so what people, poppers are something, if you're about to have a heart attack, you know, and you have a popper handy, or the ambulance guy has one, they break it, you inhale it, it opens up all your blood vessels really wide, right? You don't want to do that often, you know, because that's also a known carcinogen.
But well, they were doing it.
What's that?
They were doing it in the nightclubs.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you, and this was in my film, Fauci's First Fraud. You go to a bathhouse or a gay dance club, and there'd be a bar, and they'd have alcohol, and they'd also have poppers, because poppers were a chemical that cost a penny to make, and you could sell it for $5. So the financial incentive was fantastic. And the gay press was all running full page poppers ads in the late 70s, early 80s, or throughout the 80s, actually. And they were not about to report the truth to their readers that, hey, guys, I know you're having fun with this stuff, but it's carcinogenic. And it was not unusual for people to do 5, 10, 15 poppers a night. There were even certain clubs where they would take the popper gas and they would shoot it out into the dance floor. And we have a scene in the video. It's like it's from, you know, someone was just shooting the dance floor, and you can see a guy, he's dancing, he breaks a popper, sniffs it up. So the very first people that got AIDS, where were they getting sick? They were getting this carcinoma in their nasal passages in their throat. It was a kind of cancer that normally only appears on the skin of Mediterranean men who've been in the sun too long, and now they're 90 years old, right? And they start to get these carcinomas, right? This was appearing in the nose and the throat. The other disease that characterized early AIDS was a fungal infection in the lungs. Well, if you're ingesting, if you're inhaling a carcinogen 5 to 10 to 15 times a night, and you're going out, because this was a small group of people, but, you know, there are people that party and they go nuts. And they were doing this 4, 5, 6, 7 times a week. Well, yeah, you're going to get cancer in your nasal passages, and yeah, you're going to create a fungal infection in your lungs. So Fauci and friends took that and put a frame around it and said, this is a brand new, never before seen disease. These young, otherwise healthy young men, they weren't healthy. The original cohort of people that were identified with AIDS were heavy partiers, heavy drug abusers, and they abused all the drugs, methamphetamine, cocaine, heroin, alcohol, tobacco. The other thing they abused was antibiotics, because part of this grand experiment they were all engaged in, how much can we drink, how much poppers, how late can we stay out, how can we stay out till 3 in the morning and then do amphetamines and go to work the next day? You know, this was what, I mean, I wasn't part of that community, but drug use in New York City when I was growing up was heavy.
Yes, but it was also called GRID before they called it AIDS. I think
correct.
Just before Fauci came in.
Yeah, they want. Well, what's really interesting is right before AIDS was discovered, there was an outbreak of a terrible intestinal disease in San Francisco. And it was the kind of disease you only see among people who live in horrid urban slums in the third world where they have no fresh water and no sanitation. It's just, you know, this disasterville, right? And now you're in this affluent, everyone's got money, flush toilets. Why is this group of people getting this horrible intestinal infection? Well, they were abusing antibiotics. And the reason they were abusing antibiotics is because they were getting multiple sexually transmitted diseases every year. So they had to be treated over and over again. It got to the point where they were recommending, doctors were recommending prophylactic antibiotics. In other words, hey, just take them every day, right? That's obviously going to destroy your system. So this is what was all going on in the early days of AIDS, right? And then they decided it was a virus. And then they decided that, first they said, you mentioned, you sort of referred to this. They said, oh, if you have this, you're dead in 6 months. Well, not everybody died. You know, like, okay, you're dead in a year. Okay, you're dead in 2 years. Okay, you're dead, four. And then they said, oh, it lurks, it hides, it goes deep in. And
yes, 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 yes. It can stay in your system. You know? Yeah, for 12 years, it can hide in your body.
Yeah, or 20 or forever, right? But the terrible thing is the group, you know, because a lot of these guys knew what they had been doing. In fact, you know, there's a famous book by a famous gay activist. He was also a playwright, Kramer. Very famous. I mean, he's one of their one of the leaders of that community. He wrote a book in the 70s. I'm going to say a word that's rude, but it's the title of a book and it's on Amazon, so don't freak out, everybody. It was called Faggots. And he wrote this book about what was going on in the 70s because he was against it. And I guess somebody broke his heart too, you know, and he got mad. And so he did a tell-all about what a certain small percentage of that population, how they were living. And I mean, I haven't even gotten into the graphic stuff, but just safe to say they were doing if you wanted to run a scientific experiment and absolutely destroy somebody's immune system and induce cancer, you would do exactly what these guys were doing. And I haven't even told you all the was that?
I found the book.
Yeah, it's a real book. I'm not making it up. And who wrote it?
Came out in 2000, got 4.1 stars. You're asking who wrote it? Larry Kramer and Reynolds Price.
Yeah, I mean, there's nobody higher on the totem pole of gay activist positive people, all right? And he actually wrote about everything that I'm saying. I'm not like, you know, casting aspersions on a particular group of people. So they put a frame around this and said, it's a virus that's causing it. Oh, and boy, if you've ever had sex, you better know everybody who the person you've had sex with has had sex with, and everybody they've had sex with, and everybody all the way back to the beginning of time, because you might somehow have inadvertently gotten the AIDS virus. And if you've got it, you're a goner, and you better take this AZT. That's the same, going back to where we started, and then we'll get finally to the book, because this has happened before. This did not start with COVID, and it did not start with AIDS, as I learned by researching this book. The model is, there's this deadly disease from a new virus, and we don't know how to cure it, and it's so easily transmissible, and if you get it, you're a goner, and we're working on a cure, we're working hard, and, you know, terror, 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 hey, we got the cure, and the terrorized people just come flooding and just, you know, roll up their sleeves and take the COVID shot, or in the case of AZT, take the AZT. So I thought that I was a great researcher and that I discovered the parallels between COVID and AIDS, you know, and could articulate them. And I did that very early and in a very detailed way. But what I didn't realize is this is not a new game. Like right now I'm writing the chapters on tuberculosis. Okay. And you referenced tuberculosis and AIDS earlier. And by the way, the vast majority of people who quote, die of AIDS, they're tuberculosis patients. Okay. And there was a outbreak, massive societal outbreak of this thing called tuberculosis in the 19th century. And I tried to figure out why. Why hadn't that? Because, you know, there's a lot of medical history that goes all the way back to the Egyptians. You know, people have been writing about diseases and disease states and epidemics and all this forever. Well, why suddenly in the 19th century is everybody coming down with tuberculosis? Well, it had to do with urbanization, and it had to do with coal. People were heating their homes. They'd have a coal stove in their, like, in their living room, burning coal. Do you know how toxic that is? Like, coal is super, super toxic. You know, the smoke from coal has particulates that are so small, they go straight into your bloodstream. It goes shoom, right in, right? And when you burn coal, you put lead in the air. You know, not huge quantities, but enough for bad things to happen. You put arsenic in the air. You put mercury in the air. I know this because I worked for years stopping a coal-fired cement plant that was going to be put. And I became sort of expert on this. And when I realized, I'm like, why did tuberculosis suddenly be this big thing? Everybody had it. Charles Dickens had it. George Orwell had it. I mean, everybody had it because they were all sitting around in closed spaces, especially in the winter, breathing coal fumes, coal exhaust fumes, right? So did they say, oh boy, that's a bad idea? Nope. This guy named Richard Robert Koch, C-O-C-H, German, discovered the tuberculosis bacterium. Okay? They didn't say that, you know, like, you can destroy somebody's lungs by exposing them to nonstop air pollution, right? And then obviously things are going to happen. Bacteria is going to thrive. You're going to get lesions on your lungs. I mean, these are all predictable outcomes of breathing poisonous air, right? But instead of dealing with that, because how are you going to deal with that when coal was king? They just said Koch came out and said it was the bacterium. So here's where it gets really crazy. So he comes up with a cure for tuberculosis. And basically, what he declared was the tuberculosis bacteria. He mixed it with some glycerol, and just started injecting it into people. And he said, we've done it. We've solved the problem. And then the Prussian state, by the way, this was the German medical establishment again, started manufacturing it. The brass bands, very politicized, as was Louis Pasteur. And hopefully we'll be able to get to that. I know we're running out of time maybe. So doctors all over the world are buying, by the way, he wouldn't tell people what was in it, and he was the sole source of it, so you had to buy it from him. So people in Italy and England and France, Spain, they're all getting this thing because tuberculosis was a problem. And they're injecting their patients. And guess what was happening? They were developing fevers so severe that they were practically shattering their own teeth with, you know, the shaking. The fevers were so severe that they were shaking the beds. I mean, they were very, very, they became sick. So what did Koch say? That's a sign that it's working. That's a sign that it's working. Then, as a little more time went by, their lungs started to break down. And now all those pustule, all those like weak spots they had on their lungs, where the tissue was a little weak or had been bacteria damaged, started breaking. All right? Now these people are coughing up blood. They're drowning in their own blood. This was the cure. Okay? What did Koch say? He said, you're administering it to the wrong patients. You're administering it wrong. Your doses are too big. You don't know what you're doing. It took this thing that was killing everybody that got it. It took 2 years to have it taken off the market in the 19th century. Now, you would think, okay, well, Robert Koch, that's the end of his career. He's obviously an idiot. He's obviously an incompetent. He's obviously a maniac. No, the Prussian state gave him his own Infection Studies Institute, which is now known as the Koch Institute. It's one of the most elevated places you can go to study infectious disease in the world. Okay, now you might go, why? How is this possible? Somehow, in the 19th century, well, first of all, this 19th century created a lot of problems. Previous, you know, people would, you know, we had some fresh air, you had some elbow room, you know. Now everybody's packed into the cities. I was talking earlier that they were using coal to heat their houses and getting sick from that. But there was the sanitation was bad, the water was bad, the food supply was bad. The whole thing was bad. People were getting sick by the droves. And they wanted a solution. All these advanced countries that were getting these big cities wanted solutions. The French wanted a solution. The British wanted a solution. And that, by the way, was the, you know, there weren't that many countries that had big populations, urban populations at that point. So they didn't want to look at nutrition. They didn't want to look at air quality. They didn't want to look at sanitation. They didn't want to look at water safety. They didn't want to look at any of, they didn't want to look at people working 12 hours a day in polluted factories. They didn't want to look at that. They wanted simple cures. And it became a national imperative. So France elevated Pasteur, and I have a whole like 5 or 6 chapters on Pasteur. I'm going to tell you, everybody, total fraud. It's in the book. I'm laid out the case. Like, as bad as you think he was, when you get into the details, he's 1,000 times worse. Okay. Now, why did that work? In particular, the French and the Germans were in the 19th century were like this. They were at each other's throats. Napoleon came through in the early 1800s, destroyed Prussia, humiliated Prussia. And the Prussians said, we can never let this happen again. So they began this drive to develop their own medical system that was superior to the French system, using, you know, some of the French ideas. And it became a prestige thing. So France had Pasteur. There is literally, if you go to Paris, there is a chapel, you know this, right? There's a religious chapel built to Pasteur with mosaics and gold leaf, and it's insane. It's uncared. And then on the other side, you had Koch. So even though Koch was a crazy man and killed God knows how many tens of thousands of people and forced that poisoning to continue for years when it should have been stopped, he was elevated by the Prussian state. So that's what we were talking about earlier. It's not just the pharmaceutical companies being greedy. That's part of it. It's also states deriving their prestige from having, quote, the best medicine. And interestingly enough, if you go way back in history, the ability to perform miracles has always been part of political power. There's a funny case, not a funny case, but there were these Spanish explorers that got shipwrecked in Florida, and they made their way across the Southeast, and it was a disaster. Like, it was just horrible. But they arrived in some tribe, and for some reason, the tribe got the mistaken notion that they were magical healers. And they accidentally healed like the first 10 people that came to them. And these people were automatically transferred into gods in the eyes of this particular tribe, saving their lives. And there was also that same thing with the Catholic Church trying to take over pagan Europe. They wanted to have superior miracles to the pagans, right? Oh, your miracle's better than Thor's miracle. Okay, we're with you, you know. And now we're going really far astray. But I mean, how many people know, for example, that the guy who Catholicized the Roman Empire completely made it up? Like, you know, and we're going way off, but the cross, right? Oh, that's Christianity. That's the oldest symbol. No, the first several hundred years of Christianity, nobody was praying the crosses or wearing crosses around their neck or putting crosses in their church. Okay, that all came from a guy named Constantine. And he very cleverly decided, we can't really beat these Christians because they're maniacs, so why don't we drag them in? And he declared that, I was at a battle and I saw the cross in this, I saw this cross in the sky, and we won this amazing battle. And it was a miracle, right? And then he said, let's all become Christians. And then, of course, Rome took over Christianity. And you know, what was Christianity and what is Christianity now don't have any relation to each other, really, except in the individual hearts of people that managed to find the root of Christianity in their own hearts, right? But my point is, the link between state power And the ability to do miracles, especially medical miracles, is really deep-seated. And, you know, I'm not saying that this was consciously done, but clearly France elevated this maniac Pasteur with all his crazy theories. I mean, one of the things in the book I talk about, I don't know, did you have a chance to read his cure for rabies? I don't know if you had an opportunity. It doesn't matter. His cure for rabies is take an animal, take a rabid dog, kill it. And by the way, you have to understand, they didn't even have a sense that there was a rabies virus or not. They were just saying, here's a dog, because they couldn't test whether a dog was rabid or not. So any dog that was angry and that was frothing in the mouth, if anybody knows dogs, if you get a dog mad enough and piss him off enough, he will froth at the mouth. So they declared that rabies. So what they do is they'd kill the dog, they'd take out his brain and spinal cord, they'd dry it, they'd mix it with glycerol, and they'd inject it into people. That's what Pasteur was doing, and that's what elevated Pasteur to the heights that he's at today, right? By the way, in case anybody doesn't know, if you were to do that today, that's not medicine. Right? Nobody on earth today considers taking the dried brain of a rabid dog. I mean, that's more witchcraft, right? But that was so elevated that when he came up with the cure to rabies, that became an international thing. France poured millions of dollars into it. They launched the Pasteur Institute, which was originally just to treat rabies. Kings and queens came to visit. They had brass bands. I mean, it was unbelievable. So there has been this long connection between state power since the 19th century, state power and medicine. And our medicine's the best, even if it's failing miserably, even if it makes no sense, even if it's killing people and handicapping them, even if it's bankrupting the nation. Our medicine's the best. Right. And if I want to say one other thing and then I'll stop talking. The problem we have is in the 19th century, we started on this path where medicine was put in a black box. It's like there's common sense. There's things we can observe. There's what we've heard from our grandparents. But that doesn't count. The only thing that counts is medicine, you know, with a big capital M, and all that's in a black box. We don't know what's in there. We don't really know how it works. We don't know what the logic is. We don't know what the science is. But they tell us it's filled with science. That black box is filled with science. And anytime that black box emanates, oh, COVID, it's out there. It's going to get you. We just sit there and go, oh, okay, okay. And then they go, hey, we got remdesivir. It's great. It was pulled off the market for blowing up the kidneys and livers of Africans during the Ebola, but it won't hurt you, and it's going to cure your COVID. We're like, yes, black box, yes, yes. One of the things, taking this full circle, and I'll stop. One of the things that the Rockefeller cartel succeeded in doing was eradicating all other schools of thought. We used to have many different schools of thought, you know, homeopathy. I'm drawing blanks on all the names. It's in the book. But there were many different schools of thought, and they were derived from things that had been done for thousands of years, right? And when the Rockefeller cartel picked what they wanted to be the winner, they eradicated, and it takes chapters to explain how they did it, but they methodically destroyed not only the medical schools, but any other way of thinking. And then the other important piece is they put all of medicine into this impenetrable black box that no person could ever understand unless you'd been to medical school. You know, that's not the way the world has worked for the last, you know, 10,000 years. People have common sense. They have older relatives that have seen things, you know, and you just realize, well, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, what you're effectively saying is that it kind of needs to be a return to alchemy.
Well, I mean, yeah. I mean, if people know what we mean when we say alchemy, I would agree. People think, oh, well, alchemy, that's not that crazy stuff they did in the Middle Ages that didn't work, you know, that's a whole other show, right? But let's say instead of alchemy, let's say respect and observation of the natural world as it is, without theory, or without crazy theories that involve, you know, subatomic particles and virus fragments. You know, we can't see those things, so let's get away from that. Let's deal with what we can actually see and observe in the natural world, and let's respect those things. So if we substitute the word alchemy for that, I think everybody can agree that that's something worth pursuing, at least. But I know what you mean when you say alchemy.
Yeah, I mean, we have to approach modern medicine with a more skeptical eye, because it's become a joke. I mean, it's just driven now by money, medicine, testing. Everything is testing.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, what happened to the old days of a doctor who looked for symptoms? And in actual fact, what happened to the old days of a doctor?
Right. A physician.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, what is the purpose of a doctor today?
A drug dispenser. Order the test and then prescribe the drug. That's all they do. And as I point out in another book I'm writing, they don't even know what the adverse reactions are for the drugs. There's not a doctor out there. I'll give you $1,000 if you can find one doctor that can recite from memory all the adverse reactions known to the drugs that he or she prescribes. And I'll never have to pay that $1,000.
Okay, Ken, let's come in for a landing.
Okay. But I'm going to say this. This has been going on not since COVID, not since AIDS. This has been going on since the 19th century. And believe it or not, it was even worse. As bad as it is now, it was the things they used to do to people, unbelievable. And that's why this book needs to be out there, because we need to know, and then we'll wrap it up, that the foundation of all this so-called modern science, which is obviously, as you point, a joke, there's nothing there. It's all, I call it witchcraft and wishful thinking. And it got the power of the state and the power of money, you know, combined to enshrine these lunatic principles and call it medicine.
How can my audience get your books, plural?
Well, this one, you can go to Amazon. It's excerpts, you know, it's full chapters. The book is written in such a way that it all weaves together. So I pulled out a few chapters that stand on their own. I have an amazing chapter on childbirth, the history of childbirth.
Yes. I agree with that chapter.
As I write this book, I can't believe that human beings have survived. I don't know how we survived all this madness that these people have put us through. The child, and by the way, I'm talking about 1600s childbirth, when it got taken over by the barbers. Believe it or not, the barber surgeons of Paris took over childbirth.
Yeah, I mean, childbirth wasn't actually all that dangerous until the Industrial Revolution.
Correct, and by the way, we say, where did this autism thing come from? And clearly, the vaccines are not helping. I have a feeling, and I'll be interested when the book comes out to see if people, when I get into what modern obstetrics practice is, it's a house of horrors. Mm. And I have a feeling they are damaging kids so badly in the birth process that they're setting them up to be further damaged, you know, by vaccines. I think it's a 1-2 punch. I think that's going to be proven to be the case. As bad as what I described in 1600s Paris, modern, current, today's obstetric practice is every bit as bad. It's just different, but it's as crazy. I don't know how women survive. I don't know how women survive childbirth. Not because childbirth is this horrifically difficult thing. It's challenging, clearly. It's different, you know, but I don't know how they survive the medical interventions. I literally don't know how they do it.
Okay, so your books are available on Amazon. Search for Kenneth McCarthy.
Yeah, I think Ken McCarthy. Ken McCarthy, yep.
Or Ken McCarthy. And yep. And on that note, Ken McCarthy, thank you for joining me in the trenches.